Hello. How we doing?
Hi there.
Hey, Thomas, you can hear me. This is good. That's useful.
Hear you and see you.
There you go. How's Atlanta?
Warm, sunny, nice.
We haven't got there yet for some reason. I don't know why.
I think it's because you live too far north.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh. We got a problem.
Happened?
We don't have a host. Least we don't yet. And screen sharing is turned off by default. Nice. That's not what we want. Hopefully, someone will show up that is a host. I'm going to ping somebody. They tried to make me host, but it didn't work. Oh well. We'll wing it. So the agenda is in the chat. If you want to go in there, we'll get started in a moment. We're still early on, so we'll wait a moment.
If they gave you the host key, you can just type that in to claim the host.
Yeah, they didn't give me the host key. I've done that in other meetings, but not in this one. Folks want to go into the agenda, add your name and information, that would be great. So far, as I say, we have no host, so we are not able to share screens. So Daniel, be aware of that when you're ready to present. We'll have to tell people, we'll put it in chat what we're presenting and have people look at it on screen.
Okay.
Okay, time is 12:03. So let's get started. This is the 2020 June 10th Aries Working Group call, the afternoon call, US afternoons. Welcome to everyone. Let me move this over here so that I can kind of look at it and look at the screen while I do this. We got issue game. Can we close this? The order of this is inverted. Daniel, you'll go second with machine-readable governance framework, and then I'm going to talk about progress we're making on OO out of band and some possible updates to that. So want to talk about that. This call is being recorded. Please remember the Hyperledger Code of Conduct and be good to people. Antitrust policy. Linux Foundation has an antitrust policy. It should be followed in all meetings, including this one. As I say, please add your name to the attendees list. Again, I'll paste that into the chat. So people who were late joining in, for those who are just joining us, we don't have screen share capability because we don't have a host on this call. I'm being the host of the call because we were not able to, Sam was not able to make it. And he is the host, the Zoom host, and the Zoom host is the only one that can turn on screen sharing. So we don't have screen sharing on this one. Related announcements. We've got a meeting reviews. Anyone want to comment on those? It's the off week for the identity work group call and the Indie Contributors call. Steve, do you want to talk about what was talked about last week? Steve McCowan?
Yes. Sorry about that. Can't find my unmute button. So we went over the all sorts of different things that happened in the various working groups. I won't repeat all of that here. I can put the link in the chat, and then we can put that on the page. We did have Matt Norton from Street Cred, and they have just rebranded as, I forget.
Intrinsic.
Intrinsic, yes.
Yes.
I just saw that this morning, so that's kind of cool for them. Matt came and he talked about how they're collaborating with BC Gov on getting essential workers back to work using SSI technologies. And so we recorded that demonstration. It's on our wiki page, which I'll drop in the chat, and feel free to go check out his demonstration. It was really good.
Excellent. Okay, next up, any other related meetings anyone wants to call out? DIF meeting, Sam's not on it. So Sam's not on this call. So anything else? All right, let's go through, because we did not have the Aries call this morning, we will go through the work updates to get give anyone time they want to talk about. So Keith, Aries Protocol Test Suite, anything to report?
Not anything in the last week or so. We continue to just a reminder that I did push some improved instructions and Dockerization to make it easier to use that. So I would really be interested in getting any feedback from anyone who tries to write a back channel using those instructions. I think it should be relatively simple. So that's it.
Okay. Okay, I just added that to the notes. Aries Agent Test Harness. This is the test harness that BCGov is working on for interop testing between implementations of agents. Working on present proof. Adding a fourth agent persona. So the way the harness works, it's got personas and you write tests in the, depending on which personas you want to have interacting. So we've got Acme, Bob, Faber, and Mallory as different personas. So Faber was recently added or is about to be added as for the presenting proof tests. We just added a bounty. This has now been published. So I added that to the notes. I will also add it into the chat. So there's a bounty for that BCGov is posted. It's 25,000 Canadian. So I believe that's around 20,000 US to implement a back channel for the ARIESframework.net. So it's a pretty simple application process. It's just simply, if you have the expertise, fill out the form, say why you are the most capable at meeting the requirements, and you may be selected. So it is a government procurement, but it's a really lightweight one, and it can be anyone in the world that can do this. So we'd love to have feedback from people that are interested in that and want to give that a try. So that bounty is out there. The link is in the notes and in the chat. Aries Shared. Andrew, any updates to give here?
I think you know what the progress is there.
Yeah, okay.
I'm working on storage and clean that up, clean up that repository a little bit and make it public this week.
Okay.
As well as some related documentation.
Okay, just updating the notes for that. I put a help wanted in here. The did solve method on the universal resolver currently uses the Java wrapper around the Indie SDK. So quite, I don't know what version of Indie SDK it's being used, and I don't know how much it's been maintained, but a really good idea would be to update that to use Indie VDR in its place. So if anyone is interested in that, please contact me and let me know, and we can guide you through an implementation of that. But that's a piece that would be good. So Universal Resolver, I think most people know about, but if you don't, let us know. And I think that would be a good thing to add to the community. Aries Cloud Agent Python, I get to talk about that again. Release 051 was out, it's been out for a while. We're right now, we just had the ACAPUG, the user group meeting, and we talked a lot about enhancing the revocation support that's been implemented. Basically, as we've started to use it, we've discovered we've got too much work that the controller has to do. And so we want to shift more of that effort for managing things like multiple revocation registries onto ACAPI. So we're going to be doing some additional work in that area. Looks like we've got that fairly lined up. Out of band support, we're midway through that. Our dev that's on it is off this week, but we'll be back on it next week. But we'll I'm plowing some of the learnings that he's given us into a bit of a presentation or an update on this call. So I'll talk about that later. And then the other thing was work was done in the SVIP, the Homeland Security Consortium that we're working on verifiable credentials. So there is an accepted, I believe it was a merge PR on JSON-LD verifiable credential support. It's just signing and verifying, so it does not integrate with issue credential and present proof protocols. So all it is a couple of endpoints that allow you to sign a JSON-LD verifiable credential and then verify that signature. It's up to the controller what they do with that or anything else, but that's more sort of an initial get some JSON-LD processing into the code base. As I say, this was supported, implemented by Sam and supported by, his work was supported by SICPA in Switzerland. Okay. Troy, any Aries Go updates, framework Go?
Nothing major to report, just finishing up out of band, tests, looking at the BBS Plus signatures.
Awesome. You guys had so much announced last week, so it seems fair.
Yes.
Huge progress. All right. For those, I see it in the chat, no screen sharing, I'm afraid. We don't have the host key, and Sam was not able to transfer it. We tried during the week, and we didn't think it mattered because we were more worried about recording. We didn't think about screen sharing, but screen sharing is turned off. So there you go. I don't see Jack on the call. Any other updates? Tomislav, updates on Trinsic's work on ariesframework.net?
No, there haven't been any updates. Okay. Lately, there is some work that we did on BBS for .NET, MicroDot wrapper for FFI, and we just released a .NET version of it. I'll send a link to chat. It'll eventually find its way to Aries, but once we kind of figure out the larger picture of using BBS in it. Just wanted to announce that.
Yeah, very cool. Congrats on the new name.
Thank you.
Can you say the new name again?
It's Trinsic.
intrinsic, like intrinsic, but no first two
exactly.
letters? Yep. Okay.
It's a good name, but I kind of like Tomislav.
Yeah. All right. I don't, anyone on the, actually, yeah. Alexi, I see you're here. Any progress on how we doing on JavaScript and Java? Are you guys, sorry, I thought you were working on that. Ajay, are you, any update on that progress being made there?
Yep, on JavaScript, the team has laid out plan for 1.0, and there's some refactoring has to be done that we are working on mainly on the framework APIs and that stuff. Yeah,
good.
It's a small team, but yeah, progressing slowly.
Excellent, good stuff. Any updates on rich schemas? W3C verifiable credentials. Aries Max. Anyone have any thoughts? I've got someone who's just joined the community who is an Android developer and has been for a number of years. Any suggestion on anything related to Aries Max that I would suggest he work on?
So people have requested being able to respond to credentials, or at least have automatic credential offer acceptance.
Okay.
So it can bounce back to an issuer, but that's one piece that's missing. A connection establishment is possible, so managing credentials, I guess, would be the next thing he can tackle.
Okay.
Stephen, after we talk about machine-readable governance frameworks, I think it might make sense to look at doing some work in that vein as well.
Oh, okay.
This might make more sense after you hear what I say about them.
Okay, I'll add that. Let me just add one more thing before I go. Okay, Ursa, I don't see Mike on the call. I know one of the things that's being worked on is the revocation 2.0 using an approach that's documented in an RFC. So the idea is to get to a much larger revocation registry and to eliminate the tails file and try to make a lighter load for that. Looks like progress is being made there. There's still work. So it looks like the data structure handling seems pretty solid. We're now looking at what has to be done on the proof side. So work on that. Work on that is ongoing. I am going to paste the link again of what I'm in because we don't have screen sharing today. So for those who are just joining, we don't have screen sharing, unfortunately. So we have to go without. Okay. That's it. Any other comments from anybody on other projects that I've missed? Anything they wanted to talk about? Cool. All right. Daniel, over to you. Machine readable governance frameworks.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to repost the link that I earlier in the chat, I posted this once, but what I'm about to talk about is what I just pasted in the meetings chat. And it's a link to Aries RFC 0430, which is at the proposed status. And I think on another call I got on the topic of this and mentioned, this is a very early proposed status. It's not fully fleshed out, but I think there's enough here to stimulate some really interesting discussion. What I'd like to do, if you pull that document up, you'll see that it's quite long and complicated, and I'm not going to try to go through all the stuff in that document. What I mainly want to spend time talking about is a series of screenshots. They're black or dark rectangles if you scroll down in the document and until you hit some black rectangles. The first one is labeled Use Trust Rules, and it's, I don't know, halfway down the document or something. And the reason I want to talk about these is because I'd like to talk about this more from a user perspective and less from the underlying tech perspective. Although I want to circle back a little bit to talk about the underlying tech. But let me begin by making an observation that any of us who have been working on credentials for a while have had a number of conversations typically with people who say things like, how can I know which issuers to trust? That's a verifier question usually, although sometimes it could be a holder question. Another question that's asked that's like this is, how can I know which verifiers to trust? Another question is, how can I know whether the things that a verifier is asking me for are appropriate? I'm trying to fill in the blank. Apply for a job, ask for a loan, get into college, and I'm being asked for piece of information X, Y, or Z. Is that a reasonable thing for this party to ask? Another question is, what are the duties that I have, what are the terms of service and the rights and responsibilities that come with holding this particular type of credential? For example, I assume this is true around the world. I know it's true in my legal jurisdiction. If you have a driver's license, one of the things you're supposed to do that you agree to when you get your driver's license is provide in a timely manner an updated version of your address if you move. So you're supposed to call the office that issued you that license and say, this is my new address. A lot of us don't do that. We kind of forget. And there's not any serious enforcement of it most of the time. But anyway, things like that. All of those questions are governance framework questions. And I feel like we have been, in the early stages of the ecosystem, we answered these questions mostly by hand waving and kicking cans down the road. We knew that there were certain categories of answer and we knew roughly what they would look like, but we weren't anywhere close to actually using them. And then a second stage that we're in right now, I think, is we've written meaningful trust framework documents in some cases. We still have a lot more to write, but these give answers that humans understand. So for example, a trust framework could be written as a PDF that's published on a particular website, and there could be a section in it that says, this is how we accredit a university in Germany. Maybe that's what the topic is, you know, a trust framework that describes higher education and credentials for higher education in Germany. So there could be a paragraph or a whole page that says, you know, this is the accreditation authority and these are the rules that they apply. And all that stuff is great, but a human has to process it. And we don't have any way to model the human processing that in an automated way in software. So the purpose of this particular RFC is to propose an answer to the question, how do we actually make that information that you put in a PDF and published after lawyers reviewed it and whatever, how do we make that information something that's actionable in a wallet application or in one of our agents? And so that's what we're trying to get after. With that big, long intro then, let me start talking about the first screenshot in this document. What I'm assuming here is a use case. This is just one of many use cases, but I'm taking as an example the use case of an ordinary human being the holder, and the kind of credentials they want to interact with having to do with education in Germany. And I'm assuming that there's a trust framework that governs that. And I'm assuming that the software that the human being is using is a mobile app. With that context, then, the first screenshot is, I'm not saying that we should all build a UX exactly like this, but what I'm trying to do is say, I want to be able to build a UX like this, or have the option of building a UX like this. So the underlying system must provide all of the information that would be needed to build a UI like this. Okay. So the thing that's being surfaced in this first thing is that a user encounters, let's say they have an ordinary, you know, pick one of our mobile apps, Ozma or StreetCred or Evernims, Connect.me or whatever, and they run into the problem domain of credentials in Germany. Maybe it's because they're about to graduate from college and they get an email that contains an out-of-band invitation saying, hey, we'd like to give you a diploma. Instead of the user experience being that they have no idea what the terms and conditions of getting a diploma are and no idea whether this particular credential they've been offered is actually meaningful and accepted anywhere and what rules and stuff go with it. Instead of that, I imagine that the mobile device, as part of the processing of the credential offer, might discover that this credential is associated with a particular machine-readable governance framework and pop up this UI. Hey, you're running into these trust rules. Do you want to use them? And the thing to notice here about these trust rules is that they have a name and a version, Universitätskreditierung. Sorry, I don't pronounce German very well, but I sort of know what it means. And then underneath that, you see it has, this trust framework has a reputation. 4.3 stars, it has 18,000 reviews, and 900,000 users are actually using this trust framework, and it has hashtag education. The point of that is there needs to be some metadata about the trust framework that allows a user to judge whether it's useful and whether it applies to the problem they're interacting with. And when they get offered a credential, I'm suggesting that they should understand that there is a surrounding context. And the context should help them know whether the credential they're being offered is worth the price that they're going to be charged for it, or the bother of managing it a particular way. So I'm imagining that there's this first kind of an exposure. And then if they get a second credential from the university, they're not prompted about this anymore because they've already said, yes, I understand these trust framework, these rules about trust, and I know that they're in effect and you don't need to tell me about it anymore. So they only get prompted once. Let me stop before I go on to the next screenshot and see if I've lost people or if you're following along and feel good about it, you have questions. How we doing?
Good so far, I think, Daniel.
Okay. All right, I'll assume that that was voice for everybody. If not,
yeah, it was good.
Stop me. Okay.
No, going good. Keep going.
So, scroll down a little bit. The next screenshot is about accepting terms of service. This would be something that a particular trust framework might or might not trigger depending on whether they have known terms of service. But because in this particular imaginary example, the trust framework around higher education in Germany had a piece of metadata that said all credentials in our trust framework have the following terms and conditions that apply. Or it could have said, every issuer gets to apply their own terms and conditions, but here are four canonical ones that we recognize. It can, or it could say nothing about it. But in this case, I'm imagining that the trust framework invokes the need to tell a user, oh, here's some terms of service that go with this credential. And so it's not actually the little verbiage there is not trying to enumerate what all those are, but it's simply saying, yeah, there are some terms that go along with this. These are your rights and responsibilities. This is how you could look them up later if you needed to, and click view terms if you want more information.
Daniel?
Yeah.
Are you seeing those as being credentials themselves?
Well, it could be the case that a term is a credential. It depends on whether or not the terms of service are very formally versioned and frozen, or if they're mm-hmm. very fluid. And I think both could happen. Like there are some parties that update their terms of service, you know, kind of on demand when they need to. So next week it might be different. There's other parties that are really careful about versioning their terms of service, in which case it might make sense to issue them as a credential. And the acceptance could be a separate credential. That could be a consent
right.
Credential.
Yeah. Okay.
So, and again, I'm not saying that every trust framework has to cause this kind of UI to pop up, but I want every trust framework to have enough capacity to carry metadata that this would make sense in some cases. Now, the next two screenshots labeled issuer behaving properly and issuer not behaving properly start to get into interesting things, because read the text here on this issuer behaving properly. Under these rules, issuers are supposed to prove they're accredited by this accreditation authority before they issue diplomas. This app automatically challenged the current issuer, Faber College, to do so and receive proof that it meets the requirement. So without asking the user, hey, do you want to go verify the issuer? Because this trust framework said all issuers that are qualified to issue diplomas will have this characteristic, the software looked at the machine readable governance framework and said, oh, I better go do a challenge here. So I start a second protocol right in the middle of issuance, which is the present proof protocol. And I say, can you please prove to me that you're qualified to issue credentials? And you can see how this kind of thing, even if you didn't build a UI that looked exactly like this, this kind of thing is starting to protect users, because it's now also possible to get the second message, which is, under this trust framework, any reputable college should be accredited by this authority, and yet the university that's hoping to charge you a bunch of money and whatever can't prove that they're accredited. So you have a problem with trust. An interesting thing about the issuer not behaving properly dialogue, abandon credential just means, yeah, I don't want this thing that's being offered to me, but look at the report to auditor button. This is another characteristic of a trust framework, and it relates to reputation. What we're building in is the idea that, hey, somebody did something untoward, a suboptimal behavior, and this trust framework had a metadata property, which was, who is the auditor for behaviors in this trust framework? Who wants to get reports of misbehavior? And if you filled in a URI for that, then your software could automatically offer this button so that you could complain about misbehavior in the ecosystem. Any comments about this part?
It's very cool. One of the things, this is probably tangential to this, but I'll just mention it as something we're thinking about it on the issuer or the terms of service, is it's kind of tied, is when you get a credential, it's sort of guidance on how to use the credential. Like if it has an ID, a unique ID for it, flagging people not to use them unless something like, you know, unless under certain conditions, you would not generally want to, you know, disclose this and stuff like that. I'm not quite sure it fits here, but it's just something I wanted to put into the consciousness of the community.
Yeah, presentation guidelines, we're calling it. The idea needs some development, probably.
Yeah, and you'll see, I haven't focused on the source code that's in the first third of this document, because I didn't want to get down into the technical details that distracted us. But there is a construct there where you can say, these are canonical proof requests. So let's take, if I stepped out of university for just a minute, if we're talking COVID-19 credentials, for example, you could say, look, there's three different variations on challenging somebody for some kind of proof of health. There's the variation where you're the person's doctor and you're asking them to show all of the gory details about the test that was just done because you're trying to add it to their medical records and make a medical judgment, and it needs to be nuanced and rich, and therefore it's very comprehensive in what it exposes. And then there's the let me into the bar version of that same check, right, which is basically just you should ask for, you know, like a yes, no, or a numerical score and nothing else. You don't have any business saying to somebody, you know, what's your phone number and what was your date of birth and whatever, just to get in a bar. So those things would be called out in the machine readable governance framework. You'd say, here is the proof request type one, which is called the get in a bar proof request. And these are the fields that you should be asking for if you're behaving well. And here's the other kind for a doctor. You list those out. And then the experience of the user is you walk up to a bar and you get challenged for a credential. And one of two things happens. Either normal things that we demo today, where you say, you're getting challenged and you want to prove it. You say, yes, I click a button and your app does all the work. Or up pops a dialogue that says, you're being asked to disclose a ton of information in a non-standard way. We don't recognize this as legitimate behavior in this trust framework. So unless you have some compelling reason to go outside of pre-canned questions, we recommend that you not honor this request. And that's all becomes possible. The guidelines become possible because of values that the machine readable governance framework has embedded in it. Okay, so let me have you scroll down to the next two slides or the next two screenshots. One says about Diploma Faber College, and the next one says about Universitätsakkreditierung 1.0 trust rules. What I wanted to call out here, that first one about diploma is probably similar to the views that are in many mobile applications, mobile wallets today, except for the bottom two lines. So knowing that you have a diploma from Faber College, knowing it was issued by Faber College on a particular date, whether it expires, how many times you've used it, that's all there today. What I'm suggesting is now you can say in addition, oh, here's the governing rules around this particular credential, and here are the terms of service that went with it, and here's the audit trail that you can follow, and here's how you can get redress if you think that somebody is wrong. Maybe here's how to complain if your revocation information isn't right. All of that stuff gets surfaced now because you can say, here's the context around the credential. And then the second little thing here is just what would happen if you clicked on the hyperlink that was taking you to the trust framework. You'd see more information about it. You'd see all that reputational information that I talked about in an earlier place. You'd also see the concept of versioning there exposed. So you could say, yeah, I'm currently using version 1.0 of this set of rules, but there's a link to update to version 1.3. And you could imagine a user experience that guides you through and says, when you update to version 1.3, your terms of service change in the following ways. and the duties of the issuer change in the following ways. And this particular issuer is offering the credential in a way that's compatible with version 1.3, or it's not. So that's possible. And then you also see a link back the other direction at the bottom that the rules are used by, and then a list of credentials, so you can say which credentials fit into this context. So let me stop there for a minute. I'm mostly done with my time, and I've mostly accomplished my goal, which was to show you where my head was at when I wrote this document and start a dialogue. But I do have 1 or 2 minutes more of content I'd like to give, but I want to see if there's any comments or questions first. Okay.
Whoops, hang on. I tried.
Okay.
Just, you know, that darn mute button. A flavor of what else is in this. This is awesome stuff. What else is in this RFC? Is there, you know, protocol ideas behind this? You know, sort of, I'm wondering that state of this, having not read it.
So that actually is a perfect segue to the last 2 minutes of content I wanted to give. So there, let me answer it this way. If you scroll back up to the source code block, that's kind of a third of the way down, you know, it begins with an @ context or whatever.
Yeah.
What you'll see is something that I'm not very strongly committed to. I'm far more interested in whether we're supporting the kinds of metadata that I surfaced in the first part of this conversation, far less interested in whether we do it this particular way. But just to have an example that would work, I showed a small JSON document. And if you scroll up, it looks kind of big, but I mean, hey, it's what, 100 lines long or 50 lines long or something. It's not that complicated. And it's actually not that hard to understand. And it's surprising how much you can express, if you think about it right, in this much JSON. So I'll just hit a few of these really quickly. The docs URI, for example, this is how you can go read the trust framework if you're a lawyer and you want to read all the docs as a human. And right underneath it, the data URI is, this is where you could go get this particular piece of JSON and maybe some supporting pieces of JSON if you needed them, like a JSON LD context or whatever. The topics is how you could make your thing searchable. It's like hashtags. But look at, scroll down a little bit further and you start to see roles, privileges, duties. I want to talk about those for just a minute, because the general answer to your question, Stephen, is that I think it's possible to define a quite generic mechanism where you express certain kinds of intent in a kind of a methodical and simple way. And from that kind of, you could call it a little intent language, you can get surprisingly complex without a lot of complexity in the document. So just to give you a flavor for that, in this trust framework, we've said there are the following roles. If you look at that line, we have a role called accreditor, a role called school, a role called graduate, and a role called anyone. And then we have a certain set of privileges. So there's the privilege to accredit something. There's the privilege to issue an educational credential, the privilege to hold an educational credential, and the privilege to request proof. So then there's duties, and that's interesting because unlike the normal ACL model, this is saying if you have this privilege, well, it wants to be able to say if you have this privilege, you also have these duties. The way that these all get bound together is down in the rules block. That's a little bit lower. So if you look at the first thing under the rules block, what this says is grant the accredit privilege when the name of the entity you're talking to is KMK. Now, and when you do that grant, these duties come with it. Okay. Now, that name equals KMK is just a couple of lines above. In the define block, what we say is impute the name KMK to anybody who can prove they control the following DID. And in this case, we gave it two different DIDs. So we're saying KMK can use two different DIDs, but whichever DID you see, if they prove that they control it, then you should name that party KMK. Then down below we say, well, if you run into KMK, they have the privilege of accrediting and they have the duty of doing it safely. I won't go into all the other details here, but you can see how with a very small vocabulary that's easy to parse in JSON. And by the way, I have a parser for this rules stuff. It's about 200 lines of code. I've written it in Python and JavaScript. You can get very sophisticated in how you, you know, how you say things. So maybe that's enough to tease you without giving you too many details.
So Daniel, on the reputation, the scoring thing that you present here, like you got the 4.3 star, the number of reviews, is that meant to be a sort of a, anyone who owns this DID is, who is, how much are you providing a way of standardizing how that is computed? And
this is an area where the document doesn't specify, it just implies something. My thinking is that wherever you publish the data of the governance framework, not the human consumable documents necessarily, but the data that a machine could download, one of the kinds of data that you would publish there is reputation data. And so if somebody wanted to, for example, review this trust framework, they could submit a review to some Oracle that's at that same URI or same folder or website or whatever, where the data for the trust framework is published, and a reputation could accrue in that way. And in order to do it, of course, they would have to prove that they had a DID that they controlled. And so it would, you know, you'd get a unique vote for every DID you controlled, or your trust framework could say you have the privilege, I'm going back to the rules stuff here, you have the privilege of reviewing this trust framework if you can prove that you're a unique human. And here's the proof request that you have to use, or here's three proof requests you could use, pick your favorite one to prove you're a human. But once you've proved that, then we will give you the privilege of reviewing the trust framework. I mean, each trust framework could define these kinds of rules, and then the reputation would be driven by the inputs that the community using it provides according to the rules it set for itself.
Right.
So, this is one area where it makes me nervous, and I put this in the chat, but it feels to me like this is going to be used a lot like the lock icon in a web browser of, oh, this thing seems legit. And so I'm struggling a little bit with the kind of the, I like the idea that there is a way to create like a basis for trust, but it makes me really nervous that we might be adding metadata that's too qualitative, such that it makes it easy for a bad guy to spoof something that looks legitimate as opposed to actually giving it legitimacy.
I think that is a true risk. But I don't think it's a risk that's mitigated. I think it's mitigated by making the rules that you put into a trust framework smarter and, you know, more carefully constrained, more carefully thought out, so that they eliminate corner cases. I don't think it's eliminated by trying to like declare that trust frameworks work a different way generically.
I agree with that statement. We want a place for this. I just think we need to make sure we draw enough lines around it that we know what it's good for and what it's not. Because I think that's one of the regrets of web browsers is they put too much UX trust into that lock symbol, and then they could never really figure out how to describe it better.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I'm also wondering, where is the data that is, when someone does a review or someone does a, you know, they rate the trustworthiness of something, is that kept on a blockchain somewhere? Or,
well, I would say every trust framework is going to have to decide differently. I'm more interested in how do you represent the metadata, not how you arrived at the metadata. Once you agree that we will represent the metadata a particular way, then the question of how you got it is interesting, but it's no longer an interoperability question. And it's not a question that's going to hold up people who are designing user experience and, you know, trying to add a little bit of trust sophistication to a mobile wallet. Maybe I'm being too cheerful about kicking that can down the road, though. I haven't thought it through deeply.
I mean, it's a pretty massive difference between a lock that indicates that your session is encrypted to the type of sophistication we're talking here. That's...
Yeah, I mean, here you have a version, you have a bunch of rules, you have human-readable documentation about how they work. You can go, presumably, if you wrote enough careful UI in your thing, you could actually explore the rules in some kind of friendly way, but that was methodical. Like you could have a drop-down that said, here's all the accreditation authorities for our university ecosystem, you know, and
right.
You see links to all of their websites. And I mean, you could build this kind of stuff up as rich as you wanted, because it's all there, at least by implication. It's just how much effort do you want to go to in your UI to expose it?
Yeah. Nathan's got a good point. I'm a bad guy, what would I try sessions? I think we also need a I'm a good guy, what would I try sessions? Because it's going to take a little bit to wrap heads around this and how to use it. It also has the danger, if it goes over complex, of being a, you know, a EULA, end user license agreement type thing, where everyone just skips it.
Right.
So that's the, you know, the way you presented it with the, you know, well-known pieces. How do you handle stars, you know, 5 stars and the number of reviews and things like that, how people process that is good. John is on the queue, I think, for a comment.
I know, I was just throwing an idea out there. I don't have a strong view on it right now, but some of these topics seem like topics that might be good topics in the, you know, governance working groups and things and trust over IP. And just, I don't know if anybody had thoughts on.
So I had requested of Drummond the opportunity to go and make a presentation very much like this one with slightly different perspective, but more or less to present the same general thinking to the governance working group at TOIP. It just so happened that this call came up, and this is a slightly different audience. So I did it here first, but I do think that's maybe a natural home for this conversation. The thing that's different that I would be saying to that audience is, it's great to write the documents, the human readable documents that a lawyer, you know, buys off on, but it's not enough. We have to turn those documents into JSON or something that software can actually operate on, or else all of this trust stuff that you're talking about is just going to create an impossible burden on every user.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think if I understand things right, this touches on the ideas way back when Stephen wrote a little note on the same kind of issue, I think, like, and the idea of like perhaps credential registries playing a role and discover the DID of a legal entity because it was put in an org book because that person was authorized as a representative of the company by the registry and all that sort of chain of trust stuff.
Yeah.
I agree. It's an important thing. Otherwise we have kind of like, it's kind of like fast thinking and slow thinking. We'll have like fast verification, but slow trust.
Yeah. We don't want that at all. And what we want, I think, in an ideal world is kind of an iterative process where you have techie people like us showing up to a governance framework and hearing what kind of less techie but more legally or more businessy people are saying about a problem, and this give and take where somebody says, I'm going to go update that Google Doc with our latest language, and the tech person says, there isn't any way to model this. How do we either force them to say what their intentions are in a way we already can model, or update the tech so that it can model the concept they're talking about?
Right. Yeah. And I mean, when you were talking, it made me think of like you have been discovering a bit of a vocabulary, and from that, you know, we can have emergent behavior. So it makes me think of complex adaptive systems, and we'll discover some real set of commonalities and interactions, just like, you know, the trust triangle is super simple. You know, there's three actors and I think three or four verbs that they can perform, but I can't come across a problem that can't be, or you know, a scenario that can't be modeled.
Yeah. That's how you know that you really got to the complex or the simplicity on the other side of complexity. When you start having that experience over and over again, you know, you got something good.
Yeah. No, it's good. I'm very encouraged, and I'm seeing that we're able to communicate it to others, and they're picking it up and communicating it. And so that's good. We're getting some traction in health and justice and energy and natural resources. So it's good.
Well, thank you for giving me some time, Stephen. I should have yielded back a few minutes ago, but we're done. I'm done.
Awesome. All right. We still don't have a host, so I will not share. I wanted to talk about a follow-up from last week on Out of Band. There's been a couple of things added in this week that I wanted to highlight and get people focused on, as particularly people building agents and deploying agents. So folks that have deployments out there that we need to transition. So let me talk about that. This no screen sharing is not my favorite. I will put something in the chat. I was going to run by this fairly quickly, but I'll go. So this is a presentation. This is a variation or an extension of what I presented last week. I just sort of evolved it a little. So if anyone wants to take a look. So Out of Band, as we all know, I think most people on the call know, is a replacement for Connections that has nicer properties to it so that we get an expansion of the use cases that are possible. Last week we talked about how to transition to it. And so we agreed we wanted to give that a try. So PR 498 has been created. I created it. It is RFC 0496. When it gets merged, if it gets merged, and when it gets merged. And it basically talks through what we went through last week. The thing I wanted to highlight in it, there's a link on slide, sorry, I was going to say that as I was going along, slide 4, the proposal, in the title, there is a link to PR 498, so slide 4 of that document. And then if you want to go to look at that document, PR, as I said, 498, the one thing I wanted to highlight was one of the things that we wanted to do when Sam and I talked about this was make it really easy for someone who was using Connection today to be able to receive an incoming out of band message and sort of convert it into a Connection message and then process it without having to make any other changes. So to try to make that particularly simple. And then same thing with the ephemeral challenge. We've got the use of the service decorator when we request proofs. So a connectionless present proof. So in the PR and in the RFC that I'm proposing, I've got sort of an example of an out-of-band message and then the equivalent message that we currently process today to show that it's really just a kind of a JSON transformation to take the values out of one, put them into the other message, and then process that message. So for code bases that is a easy thing to do, that is one approach to doing the first step of our transformation so we can start step two, which is actually using out-of-band messages. So I highlight that as something people should take a look at and to verify that my thought on this makes sense. So I've got an example in there of using a connection in or using an out-of-band invitation with an inline did doc or with a did, and then what the corresponding connection invitation message looks like. So I do request people take a look at that and see if that's, make sure it's accurate and of value. Similarly, there's a connectionless present proof request, what it looks like in an out of band, and then what it looks like converted into the existing request presentation message with just a service decorator on it. So take a look at that. The other thing I wanted to highlight is so that the process of going through this update is sort of three steps. We get this PR agreed to in the community, we mark it as accepted, and we declare that we're going to do this. Step two is where, while we continue to use the existing functionality, we update to at least handle out-of-band messages that replace the existing functionality. So that's the big, that's the first required step. And then step two to step three is we start to use those, but as well, we entirely implement the rest of the out-of-band protocol so that we can start to use it fully. So that's the sort of the transition. I really would like people to look at that and make sure that transition makes sense. Even as I say it, I think it may be weak. So I really want people to take a look at that. And then the next thing I want people to do is those who have deployments, have code bases, what pace do you want to go from step one to step two to step three? What target timelines do we want to put onto those? So that's your homework, and love to get feedback on that, ideally on PR 498 or in an issue follow-up. Maybe I'll create an issue related to that. So feedback, please, on that. A couple other things related to out of band that I wanted to highlight. I mentioned last week that there's sort of a combinatorial complexity because you may or may not have an existing connection, you may or may not have a request in the message, and you may or may not have a established connection, handshake protocols entry in the message. So you've got sort of this eight variations process. So I put a PR in 499 after talking to Renata at Evernim. She had laid out a really good display of the information in a table. And so I stole that idea and stuck it into the out-of-band protocol. So there's a link to that on slide seven. oh, there's where the numbers are, 7 to PR 499. And you can see that I added the table, and it sort of shows what, based on what is in the out of band message and whether or not there's an existing connection, what the receiver is expected to do, what the receiver of the out of band message is expected to do. And I think it outlines, we sort of came to agreement as we talked through it, or went through the presentation Renata had created. And I sort of, as I say, took that and put that into the PR. So again, I'd really like to get reviews of that, and so that you get an idea of exactly the complexity in doing the out of band implementation. Cool. Okay. And then slide 8 of the presentation that I put in. There's an interesting idea that came out in doing this. There's the situation where you have a handshake protocol in the out of band message, and that handshake protocol says, hey, use a connection. And you have an existing connection. And because we are deprecating RFC 160 connections, we want to get rid of it as soon as possible. We really don't want to change it. On the other hand, we really would like to have reuse as soon as possible. And it'd be really nice if we could do it with connections. So Daniel offered a few suggestions, but Renata came up with one that I thought was kind of clever, and I wanted to bounce it to the group. What if, instead of putting the reuse message into the connection protocol of DidExchange, for example, what if we put the reuse message into the out-of-band protocol, so that anytime you get an out-of-band message that has the intention of establishing a connection, you can just use the out-of-band reuse message as a DIDCOM message using the existing connection you have. I think my idea, if we did that, would be to remove it from DidExchange. So that would be a change in DidExchange. But the benefit of that is, it can be used for RFC 160 connections as just, you know, it would involve some updates by the by implementers in basically how messages get handled. But it's kind of a new message. It allows us to proceed on. Just wondering if, I thought it was kind of clever and wondered what people thought of that idea.
Hi, thank you for your description of situation. I think it's a wonderful idea, because if I correctly understand, for now, DID exchange on the demonstrated phase and out of band on proposal. And both protocols didn't accept it, and we can do these changes without any problem.
Yep.
So I wanted to just react and say that I think it's clever. There's one part of it that's a little bit weird, but it's not a weirdness that bothers me, but I just want to acknowledge it. The weirdness of it is that you have a protocol that starts, it's called out of band, and it starts out of band, but yeah, this reuse message would not be out of band. But yep, I think that's okay.
I think that's okay too. Yeah.
I'm not hung up on it, but here's the cool thing. If you think about handshake protocols, and we're already right now in the physical world, we are probably at a point where handshakes, the way they used to be done in Western cultures, will probably disappear.
Yeah.
They might be replaced with a bowing protocol like they're done in some Asian cultures, or an elbow bump protocol, or a fist bump, or some other thing, you know, but it will be some, you could call it a new handshake protocol, right?
Yep.
Well, in human interactions today, it's already the case that if you start an introduction, you can get interrupted by somebody saying, oh, we've already met, right?
Right.
And the formalities you were planning to go through are then interrupted. But you have reestablished the context. We've already met. We talked at last week's meeting or, you know, whatever. Yeah. And it feels to me like Renata's suggestion basically models that very faithfully, which to me validates it. It's very similar to the way humans actually behave. So that's a strong vote in favor of it from me, for what it's worth.
Keith, have you done implementations at a band at all?
Sorry, were you asking me?
Yeah, I was wondering if in the work in the IBM agent, you guys had done at a band at all. Have you done any work on it yet?
No, I have not started on it yet.
And did exchange?
Yes, I have. We do did exchange, yes.
Do you have reuse in that yet?
We recognize if someone decides to share a public did and an invitation, which is then the receiver of that can recognize that, use that as sort of a correlator, mm-hmm. and the person processing the invitation can recognize it and look to see, oh yes, I've already accepted it, or actually just the invitation URL itself, you know, is one level, just to prevent someone from accepting the same invitation multiple times and
right.
and creating. But yeah, there's okay. sort of two levels that we detect, we try to do reuse today.
Okay, so it probably wouldn't affect you much since you still have a band to implement, and if we put reuse in there, it wouldn't probably add a lot of labor to your work.
I don't think so. Yeah, I haven't spent a lot of time looking at the RFC yet, honestly, so.
Okay, and I was hoping George would be here. Troy, do you have any insights on that? I know George has spent a lot of time in out-of-band and did exchange and has lots of experience with it.
Yeah, we'd probably have to ask George about reuse
okay.
And the impact here.
Yeah, okay, I'll ping him and go. I really like this idea. I'd be glad to, do the updates necessary to move this forward. Anyone see it as not a good idea? Okay. I think what we'll do is we'll finish Sam's did exchange PR since it's almost done, and then I'll he or I or somebody, if anyone wants to volunteer, please do. But I'm happy to just jump in and adjust the two protocols, out of band and did exchange, and then probably also add a clarification to maybe add a clarification to 160. We'll see to get this idea out there, and then if and make sure. People are comfortable with it, but I think it's a cool idea.
I have a quick question. Is there a particular RFC about the URL shortener?
So oddly enough, that is the next slide 9. It is part of the out of band protocol. So what we did was, because out of band is now the place where you're likely to need a URL shortener, because it's the place you construct these non-DIDCOM messages and present them. It is where we have put in a section that says, hey, here's how we're going to do URL shortening. There was an issue raised for 70 that I really want to highlight. So on slide 9 of the presentation I had, the last slide, I've got a request that we need some help on some HTTP protocol experts to look at that particular issue and look at how it's documented in the out of band, and help us make sure we've got the right description in the out of band protocol. And then I also highlight on that that we really want to be able to intervene between the out of band, the shortened URL arriving, and us being able to generate the full out of band message at resolution time. So I would like that taken into account if we can, to make sure that as we write this URL shortener section that we get it right. I don't have the expertise in HTTP protocols. So I'm really looking to others to jump in and take a look at that and make sure that the wording is right, that it's clear, and that the that we're adhering to HTTP protocols on that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm not an HTTP expert by any stretch, but I did write a URL shortener years ago. And so I'm familiar with kind of the nuances of how it works. I'm just was kind of reading through the RFC here, 434. And yeah, there's not a lot of detail there, nope, just kind of a high level. This would be really important to have. And I like, yes, shortened URLs. They're really neat. But in a sense, it feels almost like an unverified credential in a way, where you're saying, you know, go to example.com/1234, and that will expand into this big thing. And
yeah, it should come from the same. It should come from the same domain. So example.com, it should expand to another URL from the same. I don't know whether we want to say that. It's definitely not, you know, we're not trying to do the bit.ly thing where you create it and then you send it off to some service and do that. That it should be handled by the same controller, whether it's shortened or full length. I think that's the intention.
Okay, so kind of the concern I was having was if we send signed messages and put shortened URLs that will resolve outside of the signature, then we kind of lose the protection of the signature in the resolved URL. So if whoever's hosting it maintains a database, which is a reasonable way to do it, and then if the database, you know, messes up a pointer or something like that, then all of a sudden the message you think your shortened URL is pointing to will point to something else.
This is not signed data either way. This is an out-of-band message. So this is something you would show on a QR code or something like that. It's not signed anyway. This is not a DIDCOM message. This is a plain text chunk of JSON message.
Okay.
So there isn't that protection on the expanded message, let alone on the shortened one. Does that help?
It does. Yes, I'm not disagreeing with what yeah, you're okay. saying. That as I'm looking at it, those are some of the concerns I've had in the past. You know, what if I use a shortened URL and, you know, one day it resolves to one thing, one day the next day it resolves to something else.
Actually, that's in our case, in the requirement we have, that's actually what we want.
Oh, really?
We want it to resolve at, we want to define the full out-of-band message at the time you resolve it, because we want a unique message going out to every person who receives it. That's actually one of our requirements, certainly, and we'd like to support it. You don't have to do that, obviously, but it's one that we'd like to see, because it has useful properties to it.
Okay. I'll kind of watch that page as it expands and maybe participate there.
I'd really like it if you could participate, if you've written one before, and particularly the HTTP interactions going on, would be great to have you look at it. And then the guidance you just suggested, don't do it this way. Do, you know, worry about these things. That is useful.
Well, I'm kind of thinking of if we used a shortened signature, if we signed the URL, then the signature could be the shortened component, so that then you can verify whatever it was you were supposed to be looking at. And unless you want the same thing to rotate, I don't know how to do that.
So in other words, be the, or you're saying the shortened URL could be the hash of the longer.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
That way you could verify that what you think you're getting is really what you got.
Interesting. That would mess up my use case.
Sorry.
I'll have to think about that. Okay. I had the issue game lined up, but I think we're close enough to ending that I won't start that. Next week, Andrew Whitehead has been doing a lot of work on storage. And so, and the idea of Aries storage module. And so he will be talking about that next week. Any other topics coming up that people want to raise at this point? With that, 10 whole minutes short. There you go. You may have 10 minutes. That's it for the meeting this week. Thanks all for joining. Take care, all. Bye.
Cheers.
Thank you. Bye.